This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 157 was recorded on March 7th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. We're back to our regular Thursday schedule this week. We apologize for telling you last week we'd be releasing the show on Wednesday this week, but switching back to Thursday allowed us to bring you a special doubleheader episode that you're not going to want to miss. Legendary Wall Street blogger and founder of Ritholtz Wealth Management, Barry Ritholtz, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. You've asked us to bring you some equity market bulls, and we're delivering. But once we got Barry talking about how capitalism has been bastardized into crony capitalism, well, let's just say this episode is rated PG-13 for adult language and content. But wait, there's more. Nomura's Charlie McElligott has been tracking a possible market sequencing scenario that could lead to significant short-term downside risk in equity markets starting about a week from now. So Charlie will be joining us in our post-game segment to give us a briefing on the developing scenario that his team at Nomura have been writing about for the last couple of weeks.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has finally started this market correction. We've obviously hit a high very close to 20 on the upside. We're now a solid almost 70, 80 S&P points off of the highs. Is this the start of something bigger in your mind?
I think it could be. You know, our listeners have asked us to bring credible bulls on the program, and we are certainly doing that today with Barry Ritholtz in today's feature interview. You've got your credible bullish view coming up in just a few minutes, folks. But I am not that bull. I think 2812 was a key fib level. It was rejected fairly vigorously. The pop and drop that we saw on the supposed China deal was exactly what you predicted, Patrick. I know you and your big picture trading members did very well on that trade. And, of course, there is more possible upside if we get more rhetoric about how supposedly everything is fixed, or there's a China trade deal or yet another China trade deal or something. But, frankly, I think that failing any of that, lower is coming. Do not miss Charlie McElligott in our post-game segment as he talks about this Ides of March sequencing, where we're coming into a period where those key levels, the magic line in the sand where the computers start to panic and sell stocks on emotion, that level is going to be raised for artificial reasons over the next couple of weeks, and that means there's more vulnerability if a move starts going to the downside that it could accelerate dramatically to the downside. Charlie will be with us after our feature interview with Barry in order to describe what that sequence involves.
Eric, I've been waiting to talk to you about this U.S. dollar. Now, the dollar index just ticked above the February highs. The euro is decisively, after the ECB press conference, broken 113 and that February low near about 112.5. Is this dollar move going to happen finally?
Well, Patrick, I think it probably is, but, you know, closing numbers are really important. As we're speaking around noon on Thursday, I'm looking at 97.39 on the March dollar index contract. That is above the previous contract high. If we get a close at this level, it potentially is the beginning of an upside breakout. But as you know, markets famously, you start, especially when you do this broadcast stuff, you record the show early and we talk about how there's a breakout, and by the time the close comes, it's reversed. If, as of today's close, we're still looking at this 97.39 or higher, that says to me that we are finally seeing the long-awaited breakout, which could quickly take us back toward a 100 handle on the dollar index. Let's see how it develops in coming weeks.
Well, let's move on to crude oil, because we've been pinned between this kind of roughly $56 to $58 range on WTI for a couple weeks now. What's your thinking of what's the next move on oil?
Well, Patrick, we had another really big inventory story this week. Remember, last week we had a great big drawdown on inventory. This week it was the other direction. A massive 7.1 million barrel build on national crude oil inventories. Cushing, Oklahoma, also building 873,000 barrels. Wow. Super huge build. You got to believe that would be bearish for crude oil. And initially, that's what the market did, was to tick down. But here's the offsetting factor. Gasoline drawing down a massive 4.2 million barrels. Distillates, another 2.4 million barrels. So even though we had this really big build in crude oil, we also had really big drawdowns in finished products. What happened was crude oil started selling off, but RBOB gasoline was just through the roof. And Patrick, there's a certain correlation between these products. You can't just have gasoline prices going through the roof as crude oil prices go down. They have to stay connected to one another. What we're seeing now in crude oil is the strength in gasoline prices being driven by this massive 4.3 million barrel drawdown this week. It's gasoline that's dragging crude prices back up above their short-term moving averages. Is gasoline going to drag crude even higher to a new cycle high? Or is the weight that we're feeling, because I definitely feel there have been a lot of bearish signals in the crude oil tape, if I look at that chart exclusively, is crude oil going to pull gasoline down or is gasoline going to pull crude oil up? That's the tug of war that's going on this week. Initially, coming out of inventory, it really looked like gasoline was winning that tug of war. This morning, we saw a big sell-off in both gasoline and crude oil. We'll see what happens, but I do continue to believe that we're in a topping process. The question is how long gasoline prices can hold crude prices up before eventually they roll over toward lower numbers.
Let's move on to gold, because the four-year tops of gold is in that 1350 to 1400 area. I think the last guest I mentioned that was Luke Roman. And literally as gold approached 1350, it bumped its head right along the top and rejected. And here we are trading around 1284 at the time of recording. Do you think that's all that gold had in the tank? What's your thinking here on gold?
Yeah, you know, I really don't think anybody should be surprised by this. As I've said for several weeks now on this program, watch for a move above 1350 or below 1304 and expect an acceleration if we see a daily close above 1350 or below 1304. That's exactly what happened. We got the daily close below 1304. The move accelerated, and before you know it, we're looking at 1285. Why does it seem to be pausing here at 1280 to 1285? Because that's where the market found support back in January. If we get through this support level and say we see a daily close below 1280, then I think we're headed down toward 1245 or so, which is the next significant support level. I really think at this point that gold is finally doing what I would expect it to be doing based on fundamental factors. We're seeing strength in the dollar index for reasons that we've discussed at great length in past episodes of this program. That should be bearish for gold. I was really surprised when gold was, you know, really performing surprisingly well, considering the strength of the dollar. It seems like maybe there was some wishful thinking that had to get us that retest of a very, very critical 1350 resistance level, which has held for 4 years now. And it held again. And we've rejected not only that level, but we've rejected below the previous level at 1304. What that says to me is that we could be in a move significantly lower. 1180 or so is a really important number if we get to that to see what happens. 1160 is another line in the sand. And if that breaks, I think we could be headed back toward 1000. I hope that we are. Now, to be sure, I think gold is going to be the asset to own when ultimately the price has to be paid for all this central bank largesse. We're going to see massive inflation. You're going to want to own gold. I still see the possibility of a $1,000 bottom in gold before we eventually move higher. So clearly, long term, I'm very bullish, but I think tactically that there's more room for this market to trade down and create better buying opportunities at lower prices.
I couldn't agree more with you in terms of the fact that in the short term, there's risk. I personally am not in the camp that we're going down to 1100, but anyway, we'll see what happens. I want to move on to the 10-year treasury yield, though, because we popped above 275 temporarily, And now we find ourselves back at the 265 level on yields. Was that just a fake out? I mean, where are you feeling that yields are going next?
Yeah, you know, I think that as the stock market is selling off, that's helping to bring yields down. If my view is correct, which is that the market has topped and we're going to find an end to what I think has been a bear market rally and eventually trade to lower numbers, if that view is correct, then I think we should expect to see Treasury yields continue to erode. If we close below 2.60, there's a room for that to accelerate to the downside. Now, the other view, Patrick, and Barry Ritholt will express this very, very eloquently in today's interview, is if I'm wrong and the top is not in and we're headed toward a stock market rally, which is going to continue, the economy is going to improve, there's no recession coming like I think there is. Well, if that's all true, then we're eventually going to head much higher in Treasury yields. I think we're more likely to go lower, but it is dependent on poor economic conditions and a weakening stock market, which is what I'm expecting.
This week's featured interview guest is Barry Ritholt. Eric, why did we invite Barry as this week's featured interview guest? And also, why are we asking Charlie to come back for the post-game interview?
Well, we've had a lot of listener requests to balance the bearish guests we've had on the program with some secular bulls. And I don't want to get people on this program that are just the talking heads from the cable channels who tell you that you should buy and hold stocks for the long term because that's what they think works. I want somebody who can credibly articulate an intelligent description of why they're bullish. Barry is that guy. He is an extremely well-known and well-respected Wall Street veteran who is also very active in the media. He runs the Masters in Business podcast on Bloomberg, and he's a very smart guy. Now, he has a bullish view, which I don't happen to agree with, but I certainly respect. He makes intelligent, well-founded macro arguments. As to why we juggled our schedule and actually changed from our plan to release the show early this week back to our regular Thursday schedule, it was to get Charlie McElligott onto the program. Charlie is really good at lining up the dominoes and putting together scenarios of if this happens and that happens, it sets up the case for this, that, and the other thing to happen. And what he's anticipating in his Ides of March scenario is if, and it's not a certainty by any means, if a certain sequence of events occurs that causes a market sell-off to happen around the 15th of March, it's going to occur in the face of very high selling thresholds, which computers are automatically programmed to sell without emotion. That's just what they do. So we have a setup that's coming that Charlie's going to describe that I think investors need to be aware of as to what could happen around the middle of this month. And we wanted to get Charlie in. We do have him coming back for a full-length feature interview in May. But in the meantime, we wanted to get his view on this because it's a scenario that could play out and have very significant consequences over the next week or two.
Eric's interview with Barry Ritholtz is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now as this week's feature interview guest is Barry Ritholt, who is chairman and CIO of Ritholt's Wealth Management and host of Bloomberg's podcast, Masters in Business. Barry, thanks so much for joining us this week. We really appreciate having you on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. I want to start with a big question on everybody's mind, which is I've had a whole lot of smart people tell me, look, this bull market is over, the top is in, the bear market has begun, and what we're seeing since Christmas is nothing more than a bear market rally. Well, if it's a bear market rally, it's an awfully exuberant one. So how do you see this? Do you think that this equity market still has higher to go? Has the bear market really begun? And what do you see on the horizon?
So I always hate the bull bear market debates because I think most people misunderstand what a bull and a bear market is, and they have a really grossly oversimplified definition of when a bull market or bear market is over. So let me unpack three things on this because I find this area to be absolutely fascinating. I define a bull market as a secular move in markets, economies, and societies that are long-lasting and sustainable, typically running a decade or two. And I'll give you two really obvious examples. World War II ends in the mid-1940s, and then from 1946 to 1966, the Dow just continues, and the overall equity markets continue to power higher. And why are they powered higher? Well, you have 40-plus million GIs returning home from war. They have the advantage of the GI Bill. Lots of these folks go to college and come out and get good jobs. Massive expansion of the middle class, the build-out of the interstate highway system, suburbia, the modern version of passenger air travel, the electronics industry, go on and on and on. You have this 20-year move in the U.S. economy following World War II that just ultimately finds its way to corporate revenues and profits. And, you know, the reason we buy equities is because we're looking for earnings and a future discounted cash flow. And that ran until it got so far ahead of itself, until the Nifty 50 came along. Hey, you don't have to think about valuation. Just buy these 50 stocks. And so at the end of that 20-year period, an era of inflation and a secular bear market began that lasted 16 years. The Dow kissed 1,000 in 1966, and it wasn't until 16 years later, 1982, it finally got over 1,000 on a permanent basis. The S&P was similar. So think about what took place over that 20-year expansion from 46 to 66. Right, you had all these different industries all in sync, all expanding. You had a massive economic boom, and at the same time, you had these short-term recessions, you had these short-term slowdowns, you had these temporary cyclical bear markets. I find it's very helpful to think of bull and bear markets in those two terms, a secular, society-wide, decade-plus-long secular bull market or bear market with shorter term counter trend rallies that basically are temporary. Now, if you speak to most people and they give you that nonsensical 20%, I hate that definition because A, who the hell said 20%? Where does this number come from? Yes, we have 10 fingers and toes, but so there's 20%. But why is, you know, 10% a correction, 20% a bear market? Where the hell did that number come from? And notice how many times there's a 20% intraday high to low rally, which apparently people in the media don't like. They decide it's based on closing prices. These are silly, arbitrary definitions that should be thrown away. Look at the broad societal trend. In fact, I mentioned the Dow got back over 1,000 in 1982. Think about 1982 to 2000. Think about how many temporary pullbacks there were, including 87. But if you look at it from the 30,000-foot view, all right, that 18-year period where the Dow gained over 1,000%, think about what took place, the rise of semiconductors and computing and mobile. Think about the birth of the internet. And you just have all these things going on that are just tremendous societal secular moves with a series of cyclical pullbacks. So that long-windy introduction is part of the reason I answer your question as to whether or not the bull market is over. I look at the changes that have come about following the great financial crisis in 2008-09. We've had a massive build-out in not just broadband web technology, but look at how mobile and app technology has expanded. Look at the rise of material science and what's taking place in that space. Genomics is just another tremendous area. There are five or six fields that are all just doing tremendously. Automation, self-driving vehicles, robotics. This to me looks and feels more like that 82 to 2000 secular expansion than it does that 1966 to 1982 bear market where we can't get out of our own way. So to conclude, I don't see any indications that the economic machinery that has been driving the United States and the rest of the world forward is coming to any sort of serious stop anytime soon.
Now, just to play devil's advocate, by your own definition, a real bull market has to be driven by real economic drivers. And the counterargument, although it sounds like you don't agree with it, some people would say, look, Barry, since 2009, this tripling of stock prices has occurred in the face of the first and only in recorded history experience of coordinated central bank easing by all of the central banks around the world. This whole thing has been driven, in the eyes of some people, by central bank largesse. And now that we're moving into quantitative tightening, if quantitative easing drove us up, surely they would reason quantitative tightening has to bring us back down. How do you respond to that? Are they just missing what the real drivers are of the market, or how do you see that?
Well, first, let me start with an ad hominem attack. Every person I hear making that argument has missed most of this rally off the lows. So they're sort of nursing a wound, and they're very unhappy. So start with that unfair attack. Now let me move to a fair attack. First, a factual correction. This has not been a coordinated central bank operation. Let's clarify how this worked. The U.S. in 08 began taking rates down to zero and then began quantitative easing 6 months or 8 months later. Remember, the rest of the world thought we were crazy. Hey, you're going to cause hyperinflation over there in the U.S. What are you doing? It was only a couple of years later where Japan said, you know, maybe those Americans are onto something. And then a couple of years after that the Europeans started doing it. It's not a coincidence that the U.S. economy and stock market bottomed first, followed by Japan and then Europe. The markets rallied first and the economies came around first. It hasn't been synchronized. It's been sequential, and that's unusual. Usually, it's coordinated. So one small factual correction. Second, I suggest people who believe that do a little homework and go back through history and look at what happens when major stock market indices are cut in half. How often is that a good time to make investments? And I think they'll find that, hey, if you like stocks that are inexpensive and if you like buying on a contrarian basis when everybody else is selling, I think you, as you would expect, buying markets when stocks have been cut in half, it doesn't always work immediately, but it tends to be a pretty decent response. So that's number two. Number three, and this has nothing to do with central banks, but it's important, there is an awful lot of capital sloshing around global markets looking for a home. This isn't due to central banks. This is due to a massive amount of wealth creation over the past 30, 40 years. Whether it's real estate or energy or manufacturing or technology, there is a butt ton of money out there. And it's astonishing. Maybe it would have been better off if this money had been put to work in more productive methods than buying $100 million penthouses. But there is a shit ton of money around, and it's looking for a home. Some of that has to do with the Fed, because the Fed has made more traditional safe assets far less productive than they used to be. But I think when people turn around and say this entire rally is due to the Fed, really don't understand how economic cycles work. They don't know what recoveries from a credit freeze look like. And they maybe are a little too skeptical about the general nature of global economies. Sitting on the credenza behind my desk is the book Triumph of the Optimists, 100 Years of Global Investment Returns. And, you know, as much as the negativity sounds genius so often, remember, most of the time, markets tend to go upwards. Most of the time, human ingenuity is creating new technologies, new products, new services, and that's what drives the economy.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar. There's so many people that are calling for, okay, this is it. We're about to have the dollar crash. The world's coming to an end. Yet it seems like in many ways, even in the face of the Fed making an announcement that ought to have been dollar bearish, we're still seeing the dollar very resilient. What's going on here? What's driving the dollar, and how much higher could it potentially have to go?
So let me answer your second question first. I haven't the slightest idea. Now let me answer the first question. The reason the dollar is resilient is twofold. A, our economy is doing pretty well. It's not on fire. You know, what are we, 1.5%, 2%? There was a slowdown in retail sales, and certainly the trade war ain't helping anything. Not that it's all that fatal so far, but it's a mild headwinds. And so, you know, if you want to find things, you can poke about. The government closure certainly didn't help. But on the other hand, look around. What are your other choices? Are you going to go buy the pound in the face of a dealless Brexit, or the Chinese yuan, or the yen, or the euro? There's no place to go. You know, someone once said, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And the dollar is the one-eyed man.
Let's talk about bond yields and U.S. Treasury bond yields in particular. You know, there were so many really smart people, whether it be Jeff Gundlach or whoever, saying, look, this crazy move in interest rates super low was driven by central bank policy. Central bank has been very clear that policy is ending. That means that the low in yields is in and it's all uphill from here, obviously with cycles in between and bumps in the road. In yields, and a lot of them even really put their neck out in the line and said, if we break 3.10 on that 10-year yield, baby, it's all over after that. And we broke it, and it was a false breakout, now we're back down to 270. So what is this telling us? Is it a recession signal? Is it just a pullback? Or which way do you think we're ultimately headed with bond yields? And do you agree with Jeff Gundlach's view that the bottom is in for yields?
I love Jeff. I am happy that someone like him is out making interest rate forecasts, so it spares me the indignity of doing so and being wrong half the time. So that's number one. Number two, and I think this is very much overlooked by a lot of people, there has been for the past decade or so, maybe even 20 years, a shortage of high-quality sovereign debt issuance, which is kind of shocking when you look around the world and you see the amount of deficits that places like the U.S. and elsewhere are running. Look at Japan, look at the U.S. That's before we get to any of the mayhem in South America. But again, there is so much wealth and so much capital sloshing around that if you want high-quality debt, there just isn't enough of it to go around. How else can you explain people paying the Japanese, here's $100 million, and here's my fee for you to hold this money? The negative yields that we've seen over the past 10 years make no sense. There's no other rational explanation I've come across other than there's just not enough bonds to go around. Now, some of it might have to do with the balance sheet of the Fed expanding to over $4 trillion. And other central banks, look at how the Japanese are basically buying everything from lawn furniture. It's not just bonds, it's stocks, it's like old lawn furniture. If you put that out on your yard in Japan, the Japanese central bank will buy it. They're buying everything. And so when you have three giant consumers of fixed income products, especially as in the U.S., high quality fixed income products, there's just not enough to go around. And that means that, you know, prices up, yields down. It's really an amazing underestimation by the entire fixed income world. It's a change. Remember when the, 2010, the letter went to Bernanke and the rest of the Fed warning of hyperinflation and uber high yields? Yeah, that didn't happen. So there's something wrong with that formula. There's something wrong with the way people are conceiving this. The only explanation that I've come across that makes any sense is shortage of paper.
Now, that shortage of paper of high-quality bonds has a number of knock-on effects, and one of them is that it has resulted in there being a really strong bid for not-so-high-quality bonds, junk bonds, to the point where we've got this just massive, massive amount of triple B rated, you know, just barely investment grade, as well as junk rated debt in the United States. A lot of it came out of the shale patch. In Europe, we've actually reached the point where there's junk rated European corporate debt that's yielding less than U.S. 10-year treasuries. It seems to me like, yeah, I understand for all the reasons you just described why that bid is there and why this is happening. So I get it. But it seems to me like a setup that when the economy turns, boy, well, there could be a real problem with this junk-rated debt. Do you agree? And how do you think this plays out?
You know, The whole concept of return is a function of how much risk you're willing to assume, right? So when I go out and I buy an equity index or a specific company, I'm assuming certain risks, what future profits are going to be like, how the market is going to do, et cetera, and I have an expected return based on that risk. When someone is buying triple B or worse, or something that's really junk, you know, the near junk is dubious in and of itself, and is willing to accept a 2.5-3% return, that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So either the market is wrong, and by the way, I don't say that sarcastically, the market is frequently wrong, especially at major turning points. Remember, in 99, everybody was convinced trees grow to the sky, and in 2009, everyone was convinced equities had no value. So when everyone's on the same side of the boat, they collectively tend to be wrong. I can't really wrap my head around bond yields that low for credit quality that bad. I don't know how it ends poorly. It seems too obvious to say, hey, this is going to roll over and die tomorrow. And remember the famous irrational exuberance speech was, what was that, 1996? So things could look terrible and keep going on for 3-4 years before they actually manifest itself as a market turn. I remember, personal war story, I remember doing a refinance on my house. The first house I bought was in 01 or 02, something like that. It was 01. We moved in before 9/11. And we did a refi in something like 04, 05. And I'll never forget, this guy literally pulls up into the driveway, flings the door open, leaves the engine running, runs into the house, sits down at the, my wife and I are sitting at the dining room table. He's standing over us, sign, sign, initial, initial, sign, sign. Here's a check, because we did a $25,000 cash out refi to redo the kitchen. And he apologized. I'm sorry, I'm so busy. I have a closing around the corner that they double scheduled. I have to be there in 3 minutes. And he runs out the door. If he was there a grand total of 4 minutes, and we walked finished by not only lowering our interest rate 300 basis points, but I think we ended up with $25,000 or $30,000 in a check. I remember looking at my wife and saying, something is very, very wrong here. I have to figure this out. And it still took years and years before the whole thing blew up. So very often things can look ridiculous and not make any sense whatsoever, but before it reaches that tipping point, a whole lot of other things have to come to pass.
Speaking of things that can go on for longer than a lot of people thought possible, quite a few really smart people in the industry have opined that China's credit expansion since 2009 is a ticking time bomb, and it could potentially send a deflationary wave around the world when it pops. Kyle Bass has been making that bet for, I've lost track of how many years now. He's obviously a very, very smart guy, but it hasn't come true yet. Do you think that China's debt bubble is a risk to the global economy? And if yes or no, why?
So there's a million things that are a risk to the global economy. The problem is China has its own currency. They're not borrowing from outside lenders like we are. And if they want to keep printing money and building infrastructure, who knows how long this could go on for. I'll quote Oak Tree Capital's Howard Marks by saying, in this business, there is an enormous difference between being right and being early. And it's indistinguishable if you're early enough from being wrong. So if you make a certain bet and it turns out not to come true year after year, you're not early, you're wrong. The old joke is always give a price or a date, but never both at the same time. And so people have been warning about these things for a while. Maybe one day the China debt bubble comes home to roost, but they have their own currency, their centrally planned economy. They have a million various corporate and sovereign entities all competing to give them more and more business and have them become the manufacturing heart of the world. Of all the things I worry about, the debt bubble in China doesn't make the top 10 list.
Another trend that we're seeing is a global rise in populism, and certainly the Yellow Vest movement in Europe has gotten a lot of attention as more and more workers around the world are getting fed up and feel frustrated that it feels to them like the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And in many parts of the world, they're really responding with violent protests. In the United States, we have a different flavor of that, where the Democratic Party has almost transitioned itself, or parts of it have, into the Democratic Socialist Party. And things that would have gotten you arrested for saying out loud during the McCarthyism years in the United States are now becoming the official campaign platform of presidential candidates. So what is going on here? We try not to take sides in political issues, but it seems like there is a trend toward both populism and among younger generations an affection toward more socialist and less capitalist ideology. What would that mean for markets if that trend continues?
So, wow, there's a lot to unpack in that. So let's start with the 30,000-foot view and drill down. Old economies versus new economies. You know, if you read books like Steven Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature and other such works, Hans Rosling is another one. Hey, the data is pretty clear. Things have been getting better for much of the world, and in many cases, much better. Literacy rates are up. Criminality rates are down. The median income has gone up and up and up for people, especially in emerging markets or frontier markets. India, China, Vietnam, Turkey, go down the list. Those folks are all doing much better than they had been doing previously. So when we're talking about the globe as a whole, income rates are going up. Now, the global economy is a closed system, and sometimes you end up with a expanding pie where everyone wins, but sometimes it's a looks more like a zero-sum game, and for some winners, there are losers. So let's talk a little bit about that. When we look at the older world economies, especially those of nations that were once great financial or military powers, the UK and Brexit, the Yellow Vests in France, here in the United States, Southern Europe, such as Italy and Portugal, and Spain, there, and Greece, there are a lot of economic problems, some of which are not being handled well internally. And I'm not living in a glass house and throwing stones. I'm talking about U.S. and the U.K. and France and elsewhere. Part of the problem is that the economy is very dynamic and it's always changing, and the nature of innovation and changing economic job options and technology and the creative destruction that goes with it, it is very problematic depending on who you are and what you do. I actually just posted a chart today on Ritholtz.com that shows 150 years of U.S. employment history. You go back a century, over 50% of the U.S. economy was agriculture. Half the jobs were agriculture, right? That now is less than 4%. Construction didn't exist as a job 150 years ago. I'm sorry, 100 years ago. Transportation didn't exist as a job 150 years ago. And that's before we get into things like financial services, healthcare, telecom, et cetera. So you have a very dynamic, creatively destructive economy that leaves a lot of people behind. I have been fond of saying, you know, since 2010, the recovery is here, it's just not evenly distributed. And if you want to know how well you're doing in the United States, there are three questions you have to answer. What's your education level? Where do you live? And what's your career choice? And for some people, the economy has been pretty robust, and they've seen healthy job and wage increases, and their jobs are fairly secure. For a lot of folks, especially if they're working in older line industries, their recovery is either barely here or not here at all. And we see that in the UK, we see that in the US, we see that elsewhere. And that has led to some degree of populism. And there's been a pushback in general to capitalism. But here's the problem, and I think this is really important. People are unaware of the difference, not between capitalism and socialism, but they're unaware of this mutant, virulent strain of capitalism, the nexus between the business community and the political class, where very, very unique carve-outs are created for a tiny percentage of the population. And that is the definition of crony capitalism. Look at the pushback here in New York City to the Amazon headquarters. I'm a giant Amazon fan. I've been a client of theirs since I got a gift certificate from my college roommate in 1998. And yet there was a lot of pushback to all of these incentives and tax cuts and what was really seen as a bunch of cronyism. Hey, why does the wealthiest man in the world, running the third most valuable company in the world, need incentives to open a headquarters? Dude, here's a crazy idea. Build your own fucking headquarters on your own dime. Stop being a socialist. You want to talk about socialists? The NFL team owners who squeeze towns for every last penny they can get to build a stadium. Last I checked, that's your private company that's operated for profit. Why does the local state or city have to subsidize your for-profit business? Stop being a socialist and pay for your own goddamn state. I give you a million examples. By the way, General Motors was notorious for being really rapacious in extracting deals that never worked. These things never work to the advantage of the municipalities. It's always a huge advantage to the company. Look what just happened in Wisconsin with Foxconn. They basically promised all this stuff. They wrung all these future favors. Meanwhile, that LCD factory is not going to be built. We're not going to see 10,000 new jobs. The whole thing was just, as all these crony capitalist nonsense things are, they're always a giant fraud. There was a fantastic Bloomberg article earlier this week about this new carve-out in the 2017 tax reform bill that gives people on Wall Street special incentives and tax benefits to buy private jets. I mean, if you want to know why people today, why the millennials today and the young people today are enamored of socialism, look no further than this sort of bullshit. This is just a complete corruption of capitalism as Adam Smith envisioned it. It's corrupting. It's corrosive. Of course young people look at it and say, wait a minute, I don't have health care. I can't afford to buy a house, but these guys are getting subsidized private jets? Fuck you. I'm going to join the Socialist Party. And if capitalists want to protect their own asses and save the system, they have to come out and say, hey, this is bullshit. Everybody has to follow the same rules. Here in New York, Google has just doubled the size of its workforce, and they're adding another 7,000 jobs without asking for tax breaks, without asking for special dispensations. They basically said, we understand the rules of the game, and we want to be here because this is where there's talent, and they're doing it very quietly. Apple is doing the same thing. Apple has a really substantial workforce in New York City without asking for handouts. When you're one of the three wealthiest companies in the world, hey, it's really bad optics to say, grease our palms or we'll go somewhere else. And I could give you hundreds and hundreds of other examples like that. I remember when McDonald's had set up a McHelp line so that instead of paying their workers a certain amount, they were moving some of their salaries off onto the social safety net. So you would call up your McHelp line and they would walk you through how to get food stamps and welfare. And it's like, hey, you're a private for-profit company. Don't ask me as the taxpayer to subsidize your labor costs. You know, and if you have to make your shitty hamburgers cost 50 cents more, then go do that. But it's not my responsibility as a taxpayer to subsidize that guy's football tickets or that person's hamburgers. This is capitalism 101. And we have forgotten this. We have gotten far, far off our path on where we're supposed to be. I'm sorry to have gone off on a rant, but I have to tell you, I find these NFL owners to be a bunch of chicken shits, cowards. Do we want to start talking about the financial crisis? Hey, see that building downtown with the nice columns on it? It's called a bankruptcy court. And if you're too fucking incompetent to manage your own risk, then walk your dumb little bank over there and declare bankruptcy. That's what it's there for. Don't come to the government and ask for a handout. Don't come to the Federal Reserve and say, rescue us. Fuck you, you're out of business. And I wish, not to get all crazy on you, but I wish more people understood what real capitalism is supposed to be like. It's supposed to be about risking your own capital, being creative, and innovating. Not, hey, I know a guy at the Treasury who will bail us out if this doesn't work. This sort of privatized gains but socialized risks, that's nonsense. That's not what capitalism is. And a guy named Nick Hanauer was one of the first outside investors outside of the family in Amazon.com 25 years ago. And he wrote a big piece a couple of years ago saying, hey, I'm a plutocrat and I'm concerned that the pitchforks are coming for us. And it turned out he was very prescient. First, it was populism. And next, it's going to be socialism. The capitalists in this country have to stand up to the cronyism, to the absolutely corrupt system that Adam Smith would not recognize the economic system in the United States. We replaced a meritocracy with something that is just a corrosive, negative grift. And we can't be surprised when people get elected and are promising guaranteed incomes or health care for everybody or free college for everybody. Hey, if you're going to just give yourself tax breaks for private jets, why shouldn't I have health care? It's inevitable. It's not a threat. Here's the road we're going to go down unless the real capitalists step up and say, hey, carried interest, this is bullshit. Let's get rid of it. And they've been warned. When the shit all collapses, don't say you weren't warned, because it's coming. And until you cronies stop dealing with this, stop begging for handouts and begging for special tax cuts, this is not the when you asked before about a debt bubble in China, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about a bunch of pigs stealing so much in terms of crony tax cuts that eventually it all comes down. The one silver lining in this that makes me happy is one of the biggest group of cronies were the medallion cab owners who created a artificial monopoly restricting the number of medallions around. And they did it because it was regulatory capture. Instead of the Taxi and Limousine Commission here in New York and in other cities operating to protect the actual drive using public, the passengers, suddenly these owners had a suddenly they had a valuable asset that was going up in price, and so they didn't want more cabs to be issued, more medallions to be issued, because they were afraid the value of their medallion would fall. You know, when Uber came to New York in 2010 or 2011, there were actually less hailing medallions on the streets than there were when they first were created in 1938. That's an astonishing statistic. The city grew immensely, and there were less cars that could pick you up on a hail. So I'm thrilled that technology came in and broke up that monopoly, and Uber just destroyed the value of the medallions. It went from $1.3 million to $250,000 over 8 years, and that's what happens when technology breaks a monopoly, breaks crony capitalism. But I don't know if technology can do that across the boards everywhere else. That's one of my big concerns. It's not socialism, it's crony capitalism.
Well, Barry, I could not possibly agree more. It's no surprise that younger generations think the current system needs to be thrown out. They're right. It does need to be thrown out. And the sad part is how few people are able to see that capitalism is not what we need to throw out. It's what we need to go back to after we throw out the system of corruption and cronyism, which has been mistaken for capitalism for far too long. But I want to go a little bit deeper on this issue, because the generation that is starting to, I think, be lured to socialism because they're so appalled by the cronyism that you've just described, they're really getting behind this idea of modern monetary theory. The concept that supposedly there is no downside for countries like the United States that are able to borrow in their own currency. basically, the argument is deficits don't matter as long as they're not causing an inflation. As long as there's no inflation, we can monetize the federal deficit to our heart's content. There's no problem. And this, I think, potentially leads to a whole lot of additional expectations of more entitlements and so forth. What could go wrong in this story?
Well, here's the question, and I don't know the answer to this. It's pretty clear the deficit hawks have gone away, and all of the warnings that they made over the past, I don't know, 40 years, hey, if we run a deficit, it's really going to be problematic. It'll cause inflation, then it'll cause hyperinflation, and the dollar will become worthless, and blah, blah, blah. Well, so far, they've been completely wrong, and not just a little wrong for a couple of weeks or months. They've been completely and totally wrong for half a century. Deficits apparently don't matter. But here's the kicker. They don't matter until they do. And there will, again, come a tipping point where deficits do matter. Now, here's the problem with modern monetary theory. You know, on the left, you have MMT, which is going to be used as the basis for things like guaranteed basic income and college for everybody and Medicaid for all and go down the list. But on the right, you have an equally dubious economic faith called supply side tax cuts. And maybe it's even worse than that, because we know, as we've seen over the years, that supply side is not a viable form of economics. If you're cutting taxes, but you're not offsetting those loss of revenues with cuts in spending, well, then you're going to create deficits. If you're going to have a war of choice that's going to cost a few trillion dollars and not raise taxes to pay for it, you're going to create giant deficits. So on the one hand, we have a theory that has yet to be disproven, but certainly looks suspect to me, modern monetary theory, that really says tax cuts don't make a difference from the left. And from the right, we have a disproven theory that's similarly used as the basis for deficit spending on both the tax cut and the military spending side. So far, they've been right. Deficits haven't mattered. Remember the famous Dick Cheney quote, Ronald Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. I wouldn't quite go that far. I'd say moderate deficits don't matter, but at a certain point, you can't just print and spend forever. At a certain point, the chickens come home to roost. The problem is we have no idea where that line in the sand is. A lot of people said Japan at 200-plus deficit to GDP ratio should have been there. It hasn't happened yet. So I don't know what the United States is going to where that line is in the United States. But so far, it's $21 trillion doesn't seem to be the problem. Maybe 25 or 30 or 50 is. I just can't guess where that, how many trillions of dollars becomes problematic.
There's another aspect to this that I think quite a bit about, which is, let's assume that at some point, even despite your bullish view on the economy and stock markets, you know, we always eventually get into downturns where the Fed has to take action to ease in order to react to worsening economic condition. Next time this happens, if they were to propose another round of quantitative easing, I think the political left, maybe in 2008, 2009, didn't really know what quantitative easing was, but they've done their homework. They know exactly what's going on. And I would predict that if that comes about, that the really strong pushback is going to be, look, no more bailouts for Wall Street. We're going to do quantitative easing? Fine. Helicopter money. Give it to the working class American people. Support the economy by giving it to the people in need, not to Wall Street rich guys. It seems almost inevitable to me that they're going to win that political argument. First of all, do you agree that that's probably coming at some point? And then secondarily, would you agree with me that that has to be inflationary when it does?
I don't know if that's coming. I think the public has a notorious short memory. It's really quite shocking how easy it is to hornswoggle the public by telling them what they want to hear, even if it's obviously bullshit. If you haven't learned that in 2016, 2012, 2096, go back every 4 years, the public has a really short memory and tend to believe what they want to believe. There's an entire field of behavioral finance and cognitive analysis that says people believe what they want to believe, and there's even a boomerang effect. Give them evidence of the opposite and their cognitive dissonance rears the head and they believe their original false thesis even stronger despite being confronted with facts. So I'm not concerned that the public is going to suddenly wake up and find reality, number one. Number two, I don't know. I've been waiting for inflation and hyperinflation for years and years and years. Maybe one day there'll be hyperinflation, but so far it doesn't seem to be the issue. You almost need to be a pariah nation with no outside countries willing to give you goods, services, or capital in order for hyperinflation to come about. If we look at South America, if we look at the Weimar Republic, it's not easy to generate hyperinflation, and I think people may have misunderstood the lesson of that way back when. Deficits are going to have a drag on the ability for risk capital, for money to be borrowed elsewhere, is what we learned originally. All the crowding out is going to take place. It hasn't happened. So we're sort of stuck with, you know, a theory that works great in academia, but the real world hasn't confirmed.
Well, Barry, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before we let you go, tell us a little bit about what you do at Ritholtz Wealth Management, as well as the podcast that you host, Masters in Business.
Sure. So Ritholtz Wealth Management is a traditional form of wealth management and financial planning firm. We run 900 and something million dollars. Basically, we integrate financial planning with a broad global asset allocation model, all the usual fun stuff, municipal bonds, equity, asset allocations. We stay away from the expensive alternatives like private equity, venture capital, and hedge funds because A, we think they're too expensive, and B, we have no expertise in it. And pretty much it's just plain vanilla boring investing. I like my investing boring. It works out well. And then second, Masters in Business podcast. Basically, we'll be celebrating our fifth year this July in our 250th episode. It kind of came about because I was frustrated with what I was watching on financial television. I actually just told this story the other day. I'm changing planes in Chicago, coming back from Vancouver, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. And I'm sitting in the bar waiting for my plane to be called. And on financial television, there's Bill Ackman. And I'm intrigued by Bill Ackman. Fascinating guy, runs a hedge fund, very insightful, has had a couple of great trades and a couple of really good calls. Again, I don't know if I want to pay him $2.20, but anytime I see a person who's really interesting and insightful, I want to learn more about them and find out what they have to say. And instead of asking those questions, the anchor just kept asking a slew of questions that were going to absolutely be stale 30 seconds after Ackman walked out of the building. He runs Pershing Square Hedge Fund, which is about three blocks from here. But and they asked him questions. So what's your top holding? What's your favorite stock? Where do you think the Dow finishes the year? What's the Fed going to do? It was just one nonsensical question after another. And I think when you have a person like Bill Ackman in front of you, I want to know, who are you and how did you get that way? Hey, who are your mentors? Who influenced the way you think about markets? What were the seminal moments in your career? What books do you read? What are your favorite authors? Who do you like? You have a person like that in front of you. God damn it, ask them real questions. And instead, these just dumb softball, you know, questions that are just going to be stale 30 seconds later. So that kind of was a burr under my skin for a while. And when the opportunity came to talk to Bloomberg, when I started writing for them, they said, hey, we have these great facilities. Is there anything you'd like to do? I said, yeah, here's what I want to do. I want to sit down with these people for 90 minutes to 2 hours and find out who they are. And to my surprise and delight, they said, all right, try not to hurt yourself. And so that's been going on now for about 5 years. On this conversation, I am yammering 1,000 words a minute. On those conversations, I get to ask a question and then step back and shut up and let those people speak. And we've had a really interesting run of people: Ray Dalio, Howard Marks, Jeff Gundlach, Dick Thaler, Danny Kahneman, Bob Shiller, Mark Andreessen. It's really been a fascinating education for me. And I think people who listen to the show have said something similar, that they learn something new each time they hear these really masters discuss their careers and how they got to be the masters they are. I love to say it's the most fun I have each week.
Well, I certainly can relate to that. We do a lot of the same things here at Macro Voices. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Barry. But joining us in the post game right here is Charlie McElligott. How you doing, Charlie?
I'm excellent, gentlemen. How are we doing?
Fantastic. I want to assure our listeners, first of all, we are working on getting Charlie back for a full-length feature interview. That's in the works. The reason we've got Charlie joining us today in our post-game segment is Charlie's really, really good at putting together what he calls market sequencing, what I call lining up the dominoes, figuring out those scenarios where if this happens and that happens, it could cause that to happen. Charlie, you've been writing about this Ides of March scenario where you thought in mid-March what could happen is the trigger levels where the CTAs start selling stock index futures could come up almost to where the market is. Now, it looks like in the last couple of days, the market may have come down, not quite, but pretty close to where those levels already were. So give us a summary both of what your Ides of March scenario is about and also what the last couple of days' action is telling us. And I should let our listeners know, we recorded this Thursday at noontime, so we don't know the closing numbers, which are going to be very important in determining the outcome of all this for Thursday's session.
Absolutely, Eric. So the core of the thesis, and as you correctly stated, this sequencing, because it is you need a number of events to kind of set to converge and help set the ball in motion here. But it was based around this idea, a quadruple convergence, frankly, of sequencing where the quarterly options expiration, which is March 15th, and it's a big one, right? This is a quadruple which, and it's particularly large for the index options because it's a quarterly or a serial options expiration. So there is a phenomenon, particularly with this March expiration, over the past 30 plus years on average on median, where you trade up into on average on median, and then you trade down out of. And the thing that was critical about this is the same spot last year at this time where, into and out of that March expiration, mid-month, we began to see a big reversal in the market. So we had rallied 1 year ago at this time after the vol event on February 5th with the leveraged VIX ETN complex. We rallied almost 9% kind of into that March expiration from there. So that will come up later when we're talking about the CTA kind of mechanical features. But the idea here is that coming out of, because so much expires into that options expiration, that options print, and in light of the fact that there is such an extreme amount of delta, there's such an extreme amount of length in the market right now due to the options exposure, as well as meaningfully high gamma in the S&P and extreme type gamma in the NASDAQ, which is particularly crowded, particularly important with regards to, the entire growth stock phenomenon, FANG stock phenomenon of the past few years. S&P and NASDAQ are really critical bellwethers for overall risk sentiment. That this options expiration is certainly, with regards to the trade coming out of it, could get particularly volatile. When you then add in the fact...
Charlie, I just wanted to interrupt you for a second because I wanted to understand, is the risk in this option gamma delta exposure in the days coming to the expiration as the gamma will even become bigger into that? Or is it about the roll-off as that is in the week after when all of this gets off of the books? Like where is that transition risk?
Right. Well, typically, if we were trading fine up and into it, it would be on the coming out portion. I think right now, at least the action of yesterday, the action of today, you know, where we've seen this additional kind of next leg down, a pretty nervous trade, I would say, is that it's possible that if we continue lower from here, and there's a lot of folks that have made money on this bounce, you know, certainly the asset manager complex, as we've seen the futures data come back online post the government shutdown. The asset manager complex has been buying the dip since December, very powerfully, large notionals in the form of billions, nearly, I would say, almost $40 billion of U.S. futures purchased over the past 3 months. Those folks are going to want to take profit into this pullback. At the same time, the hedge fund universe, which has been shorting futures into this for sure, just per the CFTC data, but the last few days have really been pressing their shorts because for the first time all year, their shorts are actually a positive P&L contributor. It's possible that they too could be incentivized to begin to take some of that delta off that is in the market. So this could happen before going into if the tape starts getting slippery. I think what is important to note, though, with regards to these other points that are out there of convergence, is also the fact that, you know, not just around this seasonality with the options expiration, the, you know, especially the trade down coming out of as this lead catalyst, but also too, and the extremes in the positioning, the deltas and the gammas, but also too, this is around the point where we enter the corporate buyback blackout. And I think we've discussed many times before that certainly over the last 5 years, from a, you know, net dollar notional perspective, the corporate buyback net notional demand has outstripped the next largest source of equities inflows, being, you know, passive funds, by factors, say 5 to 7 times. The corporate buyback is the bid to the equities market over the past 5+ years. So as they enter the blackout, meaning that we are within a month going out into the next earnings reporting season, there's a supply-demand kind of tilt that takes place where they're no longer as actively buying their stocks as they previously would. So then you have this kind of additional vacuum layering into the market. And even I would add an additional data point is that going into earnings season, which is kind of a, you know, we estimate by March 19th, 75% of the S&P 500 corporates are in their buyback blackout. But going into the earnings season, meaning kind of a month out from there is when the banks will start reporting, you typically see hedge fund managers gross down their books. So they'll begin selling some of their longs and covering some of their shorts into the volatility that is the earnings season. So that kind of conglomeration of data points on top of what we're going to speak about with regards to what our systematic trend model is telling us, with regards to the pulling upwards of the sell of the deleveraging trigger points, it's all happening at the same time. It's all overlapping. And that was at the crux of the Ides of March, that, you know, the market has felt great all year. It's been an excellent ride for a lot of folks that played this bounce. There was so much feel good, however, that I felt like a lot of folks weren't aware of these seemingly idiosyncratic events that were all lining up to potentially create a real vacuum down type of scenario.
Charlie, let's talk about where some of these critical levels are, because the essential theory here is there's a red line in the sand below the market, at which point the computers start, I wouldn't call it panicking, but unemotionally selling, as you've described it, and that could accelerate a move to the downside. As of today, your model shows that line on the S&P is 2729. That's well below the market. And what is that number going to do for the next few weeks? How does that number come up and down, and what are the risks, and what happens if we close below that number?
Sure. So looking at our kind of three key U.S. equities futures, you know, bellwethers, as S&P, NASDAQ, and Russell in that order, what I noted on Tuesday was, you know, I basically updated this Ides of March theme that I went out on February 26th, where I highlighted this convergence of factors that could lead to a sell-off in or around mid-March that we just spoke about. On Tuesday, I refreshed this idea specifically with regards to the CTA trend universe, who, as you know, we documented, pivoted from max short to effectively max long all in a blast in January, which we anticipated. And then you saw the move in the market. They were the buyer when kind of traditional active discretionary was not there. And they really kind of lit the match to this melt up that we've seen since. The point, first of all, just before going into the specific levels, is that referencing again that rally 1 year ago at this time, coming off of the vol event and into the March options expiration, is really important because the 1 year time horizon across our various windows, and it's a mixed allocation of a 2 week, 1 month, 3 month, 6 month, and 12 month window. The 1 year window, that 12 month window within our equities signals, is 90% weighted to the 1 year window. So all of those other shorter term windows are effectively meaningless right now. So it is hypercritical then that we had this big rally in the tape 1 year ago at this time, which in turn is bringing, is dragging up, as I like to say, our deleveraging level. Right? That's part of the price impact. It's actually pulling higher the level by which this current max long across U.S. equities futures would actually be selling. So it's somewhat perverse, I think, probably to a bystander to you know, kind of understand that what happened a year ago at this time is actually having an impact on the behavior of these models now. This is actually the exact opposite scenario of what happened on the flip from short to long, where I can't remember if we spoke about this, but the flip from short to long, we had the rolling off of the February 2nd and February 5th points in the model, which in turn lowered the trigger level to go from short to long, forced the cover, and away we went. So this is a really important distinction to make right here. It's the events of a year ago that are mechanically raising the level closer to current at the market, which then means that we are nearer to a risk if we do get that kind of sell-off started, where looking out kind of in the past 5 day lookout from now, but definitely more into the 2 to 3 week lookout from these current levels, were those levels at the market where we would see the S&P and NASDAQ signals in particular flip short again in that 1 year window. Those are going to be very close to at market. And frankly, you know, using current S&P futures at 2757, we would be already flipped at this point. And that is exactly what happened yesterday in the Russell, which we anticipated and spoke to in the Tuesday note.
Charlie, now I want to just quickly jump in here and ask a question. When you're talking about this type of selling potentially coming in, is this more of a, just for our listeners to kind of be able to comprehend this, is this more of a tactical positioning where we could spur on like a 3 week market correction that kind of retraces this big rally we had? Or is this something that could be the beginning of a much bigger turn down in the market, and that might, we might see actually a very key high in the market here that isn't going to be beat? Like, what is the context for the type of selling that could come in here?
I still view these, you know, by nature, by definition, extremely short-term tactical models as just that. They're a flow that I think in the micro of the market can tip things one way or the other, can cause an imbalance. And again, as Eric referenced, these are done unemotionally. They're rules-based. There's no room for interpretation. I personally don't believe, in light of the performance environment and how many folks on the, certainly within the leveraged fund community, quote-unquote, missed the rally, I don't believe that in light of the ongoing U.S. equity fund outflows and redemptions that we've continued to see up until last week's data over the entire course of the year, meaning that retail too has missed this rally, that any dip is going to be hyper, hyper pronounced in the meantime, largely because people have this comfort blanket right now with regards to, you know, an extremely dovish coordinated global central bank reaction to the events of Q4. Now, whether or not that's the right reaction for the long term is a separate call that we should make. I think the folks that have listened to me before here know that, as I've anticipated this curve steepening due to the Fed pivoting dovish, it's always kind of a risk on joyful relief rally at first, but then markets over kind of the course of the 6 to 12 months, really the 9 to 12 months, then realize it's happening for, you know, the wrong economic reasons, the slowdown reasons, the pre-recession reasons. But in the meantime, I feel like due to the performance environment, folks are particularly nervy about missing a melt-up move. This exact scenario could in fact provide the means for them to buy and kind of get back more in line with the market. So I don't believe we're going to go too low.
Okay, Charlie. So to summarize, what we're looking at is over the next few weeks, that level that could trigger a really rapidly accelerating sell-off in equity markets is going to bump up for a while. And the number itself changes every day as your team recalculates all of these sophisticated models. But to give our listeners a sense, as I look at today's note that you sent out to your subscribers, you've got about 15, 16 days out. You've got the pivot level coming all the way up to 2,800, 18 days out, 2,801. And you've got quite a while there where it's above 2,780. So during that period in the second half of March, we got to either stay above 2,780 or there could be a really big move to the downside. If we do stay above 2,780, it sounds like you're saying that could set the stage for a melt up to much higher numbers. Is that an approximately correct summary of this whole picture?
I think locally right now, the good news for longs is this. Both S&P and NASDAQ positioning remains 100% max long in the model. And they currently, at this micro next kind of few days dynamic, are sitting above their sell triggers. But to your point, as we look out even just 8 days relative to current spot, we're actually currently sitting below. And if we were to finish those days below the sell trigger, then of course we are triggered. So looking out a week and a half, it's possible that we could see a sustained deleveraging if the tape were to even just hold at this level. And that's that idea that you're not getting that move that's an impulse sell right now, even though the Russell triggered yesterday and the Russell then traded down 2.1%, very much in line with what we were anticipating the day prior. These price levels, these pivot levels, will continue to be mechanically pulled higher as a function of the rally we experienced a year ago at this time. And then from there, we could very easily approach these deleveraging levels with these additional catalysts that I spoke about earlier, with the buyback blackout alignment, with the options expiration alignment, into a market that's really long delta, that's really long stock exposure from the index and ETF option side of things. That's the ongoing risk in the background that doesn't make this feel good. And at the very least, even if the market just sits here, doesn't sell off further between now and then, this signal is weakening. To your point, though, is a major sell down coming where we're looking at something like December again? I don't think we go that far because there's enough people that have missed this rally that feel still quite good about the relative strength of the U.S. economy, that feel good enough about the kitchen sinking of earnings from corporate earnings into Q4 and that could set another low bar to beat. I think people are comfortable still buying U.S. as the cleanest dirty shirt relative to the rest of the world. So I don't believe an ultimate pullback, even though it could be very violent and the flows could pivot very quickly, as we've experienced previously with these inflections, that it won't go back to that kind of test level of where we were in December. I think we could certainly trade down into that 2600 area. But at that point, I would expect folks to be ready to buy the dip again. Ultimately, it would still be a pretty tactical trade, I think, because there is still that pervasive end of cycle belief with many investors that I see out there. So again, just it continues to be this very tactical, very short term in nature market. And I think that's gripping people's time horizons and lengths of kind of holding periods on their trades right now.
Charlie, thank you so much for giving us this update. We really look forward to getting you back on the show for a full-length feature interview. In the meantime, though, please tell our listeners, for people who are qualified institutional investors who have a relationship with Nomura, how they can get your daily letter. Because if you're eligible for it and you don't have it, you're crazy not to have it.
I appreciate the kind words. Yes, if you're an institutional client who transacts, who has a revenue relationship over certain revenue thresholds, contact your Nomura salesperson and we can get aligned to make sure that you're added to the distribution. Unfortunately, it's not a retail product at this time, but hopefully enough stuff will be getting out there into the media where you guys can roughly follow along with kind of my worldview and looking forward to the next time I get to speak with you folks.
And do not, I say again, do not email info@macrovoices.com and ask us how to get what Charlie just told you you cannot have if you're not a Nomura client. We can't help you and we will not respond to your email. Glad we covered that. Charlie, we really look forward to seeing you again on the show and we'll be in touch to set up that feature interview.
Brilliant. Looking forward to it.
Patrick, I really enjoy getting Charlie on the show. He's one of my favorite people, and I look forward to his interview in May. Meanwhile, folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices, so please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, if you haven't already done so, shame on you. Sign up for your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains advertising or marketing. It's just the best content we could find on the internet, including chart books to support our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Barry, as well as a link to the Ides of March piece that Charlie put out. There's also an article discussing the fact that the OECD is now cutting the global outlook forecasts again, as well as an interesting article from Jeffrey Snyder on China having no choice. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.